Welcome to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud, available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, or Apple Podcasts, or head on over to the website AmericaOutLoud.com and check out the articles and podcasts, and please share those on social media. We have a big show tonight with co-founder of the Tea Party, Michael Johns. We have so much to talk about with Michael. We're going to talk about what is going on in Afghanistan, of course, and the job that Joe Biden has done, or the lack of job that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have done, because it seems like they have been in hiding ever since this Afghanistan situation went awry. So what we are seeing is Afghanistan refugees in the hundreds of thousands now wanting to come into our country. It'll be interesting to see where that goes. We know Joe Biden and Kamala Harris left many thousands of Americans behind in Afghanistan. It has been a disaster trying to rescue those Americans. What they left behind weapons-wise put Fast and Furious to shame. I mean, the Taliban is loaded with ammunition, weapons, vehicles. Joe Biden left them anything that they probably wanted. And then just the billions of dollars wasted with the way that Joe Biden fled Afghanistan. It was just a 20-year war where we spent billions and billions of dollars, and so many ask, what did we really get out of it? Rob, what do you think we got out of it?
Andrew, I'm still scratching my head. First of all, I want to say thank everyone for joining us tonight. Tonight's show, hopefully, will try to give you some insight as to the things that are taking place and that aren't taking place. And I hate saying that in every show, things that aren't taking place, things that should be happening, but they're not happening. But unfortunately, such is the case with this administration. That is a reason why we're bringing back Michael Johns, who's a subject matter expert on many different topics. He's been an eyewitness on many different things, having served in the White House as a speechwriter. He knows what goes behind the thought process and a lot of the speeches that we see, a lot of the spinning that we see. So we bring him on to give us an insight, so hoping that it will bring it, the subject matter, more close to you, and you can hopefully get an understanding as to what's taking place. Now, to answer your question, Andrew, again, I'm scratching my head. Why hasn't anyone tendered the resignation? Why hasn't anyone on the left said these people have got to go? Why hasn't the media, supposed to be the gatekeeper of the news and information that we receive, haven't come out and said these people have got to go? Now, I know that some will say, well, MSNBC, CNN, ABC, and the likes, Washington Post, they've criticized Biden's administration. They've said this was a horrible pullout. They've said this, they've said that. In my opinion, Andrew, it's all window dressing. I don't think they sincerely mean it. Because when you make those comments that Biden was asleep at the wheels, or he did a bad job and this whole thing was messy, and then you come around and you say, but Trump started this, Trump said that he wanted us out. To me, right there, you lost me. You're not serious about this. And I know people will say, but don't make it political. Like, Michael might come on and say the same thing. I'm going to make it political because, in my opinion, it is political. Everything has become political. And when I look at what has happened with Joe Biden, how he was elected, and how he told all of us that he was going to have this group of people that were experts, and the media harped on it, and social media harped on it, and they blocked out anything else because they said he had these top dogs that were going to come in, they were woke, they were diverse, and they had all this background and knowledge. And then to stumble over something like this and embarrass us on the world stage, we've got a serious problem here. John McCain, the deceased senator from Arizona, warned us in 2014 that Anthony Blinken should not be allowed to serve as the undersecretary of state. How then did he become the secretary of state in 2021? How then are we to believe that things have changed when we saw him come out on the world stage in Alaska, kowtowing to the Japanese when they put him in his place, saying, don't tell us about human rights abuse when you guys have Black Lives Matter? And what does he say? He's quiet. And then he comes back to the United States and asks the UN to investigate the United States and our racist issues. Really? What's going on here? And then let's move up to Afghanistan. when things were falling down, Joe Biden was on vacation. All of his immediate office staff were on vacation, and no one wanted to run to the mic and say, this is what's happening, and we've got this under control. It was almost as if, though, don't worry about that. Don't bother me. We're entitled to a vacation. We'll see you later. And then as things began to percolate and oversaturate, and the media, liberal media, started to question, where is Joe Biden? Joe, we can only help you so much. Get out there. And then when they did come out, they were stumbling and they looked as if though they were deers in headlights. There was no reassurance. Tony Blinken looked as if though he was sad, he wanted to cry. He looked defeated when he came on the Sunday morning talk shows. Lloyd Austin fumbled and mumbled over what was happening. And then you had Mark Milley, who wasn't much better. These were two woke generals standing before the American people looking defeated, and we're supposed to have assurance in them. And to this moment, none of them have decided to resign. Now, while I'm talking, while we're airing this, there's a possibility that they might step down, but it's long overdue. Because if you recall, during the Trump administration, every day just about, there was a headline with people threatening to resign. We had Defense Secretary Esper said that he would resign. This happened back in 2020. Kirstjen Nielsen, she was going to threaten to resign back in August of 2019. You had Attorney General Barr threatening to resign if President Trump fired Christopher Wray. You had two top defense officials saying that they were going to resign if Trump made them put a rubber stamp on an unproven COVID-19 vaccination. And the list goes on and on and on of people threatening to resign or going to resign because this didn't happen and that didn't happen. Well, by God, we just slipped on the world stage. Where are the headlines that asking for this person to resign or that person? I mean, imagine we just created a powerful army, weaponized army in the Middle East. They have more artillery, more ammunition, top-notch ammunition than some countries. But quiet as it's kept, we're told don't look at it. We'll chastise Joe Biden just a little bit. But remember, this is Trump's fault because Trump would have done the same thing. I think it was Bill Maher said, well, guys, come on, this is so Trumpian. Had Trump been into office, the same thing would have happened. I beg to differ. And we can look at the record and notice that that wouldn't have happened. Because if anything, Trump wasn't a warmonger. But if you mess with him, he would come after you. And maybe that was the reason why he kept them in check, because they didn't know if he was going to come after them or not. And I think one of our guests, Heather Robinson, even said that a lot of people felt that Trump was crazy. No, he wasn't crazy, but they knew, wait a minute, this guy has a strength. And believe it or not, as Colonel Hall said when she came on, that side of the world, they respect strength. They don't respect bowing down like Barack Obama. They don't respect you saying, oh, well, let's make nice. No, they want strength. And unfortunately, Joe Biden did not demonstrate strength. He has not demonstrated it, and neither has his administration. No one has demonstrated strength or power. What they have demonstrated is that we have failed on the world stage. It's embarrassing. Very embarrassing. How do we recoup? How do we get back? The attacks that we just recently launched on the Taliban, and in my opinion, Taliban, ISIS, or whoever they want to call themselves, Al-Qaeda, they're all terrorists. I don't care if they're fighting amongst each other. They will do that. But when it comes to the West, they will stand locked together to attack us. So that's my spiel on it. And it's unfortunate. It looks very bleak, but I don't know how we get out of this. Michael, what do you say?
Well, this, I have to say, so far, the Biden administration has completely mismanaged this. And it goes really back to early July when the primary military airbase in Afghanistan was abandoned, much like the country ultimately was, without any turnover ceremony, with multitudes of valuable Air Force equipment still there in a air base that we had invested tens of millions of dollars into in recent years, and which once during the Cold War was kind of the centerpiece of our Central Asian presence against the Soviets. So you look at that air base and the way that was handled, and you have to conclude, I have concluded at least, that the decision to make an expeditious retreat out of Afghanistan without any regard to the governance of the country, the stability of the country, U.S. interests in the region, the probable emergence of the Taliban, the constitution of Afghanistan, which I've tried to put a little bit of focus on here in over the last week, and this vast investment of a 20-year war under which 2,420 Americans in military gave their lives, almost 4,000 contractors, vast majority Americans, gave their lives. Estimates of the cost, I mean, this is so costly, it's difficult to even get a precise number, but you know, numbers are as high as $5-7 trillion. Give that perspective, you could rebuild the infrastructure of the United States 3 or 4 times over for what we've spent in Afghanistan. So this has been mismanaged. And by the way, it's, I think, important to point out that the only rebuttal that the Biden team has been able to offer, including Biden himself, they all look hugely uncomfortable in trying to justify this. They seem to not believe it even in the way they're communicating. They're not really offering any logical explanation except to say, well, Trump was going to get us out and had an agreement to get us out by May. That's true, but that was a condition-based withdrawal, meaning as certain thresholds were met, as the Taliban met certain thresholds, we would in turn reciprocate. Under no circumstances could I have envisioned President Trump retreating from Afghanistan, handing this country to the Taliban, essentially going all the way back to the pre-9/11 conditions of Afghanistan, and then leaving on top of it billions of dollars in American and NATO military equipment, including, and thousands of several thousand Americans, unknown number, they can't even identify it, this administration.
But Michael, before you go on to that, to the unknown number, I want to just step back to what you were saying as far as what we left behind and everyone saying, well, Trump had agreed to this. It was a conditional-based agreement. That's if right. You do certain things, certain benchmarks, and the media refuses to point that out. They keep saying, well, President Trump, he said this, he was going to do this. And even if that were the case, everything that Trump had put in place, Biden has come in and struck down. So if he felt that this agreement was unachievable, he should have just said, we're going to redo this. Why didn't he do that? And the media refuses to call him out. I was even looking at Fox News, Peter Doocy. And Biden said, well, you know, my predecessor, he did the same thing. And I'm like, okay, Peter, follow up and said, but Mr.
Yeah,
President.
Peter had a good question, but not a good rebuttal to.
Exactly.
His question was great.
It was the only rebuttal.
Real question, I thought, a serious question asked. Well, some of them were semi-serious, but it was the only one that really kind of asked what needed to be asked. We have this agreement that Trump initiated, to his credit, really, all the way back in February of 2020, that was signed with the Taliban, that has essentially 4 components to it. And they're all condition-based components, including to the Taliban's affirmation that they would not permit any terrorist-based entity to operate on the soil of Afghanistan. They would not attack or engage U.S. forces at any time during the withdrawal. Of course, both of those have already been violated. Al-Qaeda and ISIS are both operating on Afghanistan soil, probably have been for a while. And we've just had, you know, an incredibly devastating killing of American Marines. So, you know, under this agreement, you would not have seen the final withdrawal of American forces. And you certainly would not have seen the abandonment of key military assets, like the primary air base in Afghanistan, that now I think create conditions under which, this is the most frightening sort of reality, but be an oversight not to mention it, in which this becomes something of a terrorist super state, in the sense that both Pakistan and China's Communist Party appear likely willing to embrace this entity. They've certainly shown favoritism toward the Taliban up to now, and not a whole lot of concern as it relates to their vast human rights atrocities and their war crimes. And, you know, and now this kind of welcoming potentially of all of the radical Islamic elements, once again, have, you know, a country that's likely to protect it. And of course, Pakistan and China, it's important to point out, are both nuclear powers.
Right. And when we don't, we being the media, don't follow up with a rebuttal and just go in and say, but Mr. President, and challenge him, I think we do a disservice to the American people, to those individuals who can't be there to ask those questions. Because I can only imagine if it was a family who had lost a loved one, they would have said, but Mr. President, the buck stops with you, as you said, and you have changed everything else that the previous president had put out there. Why didn't you change this if you felt that it wasn't in our best interest, Mr. President? Why is it, Mr. President, that you haven't been more vocal than you are? Why is it, Mr. President, that you don't ask, you don't answer questions from the media? Why is it, Mr. President, that you only answer selected questions? These are the things that we need to know. This is our supposed to be our leader, the leader of the free world. And when he gets on the stage and stumbles and says things like, well, they told me to call on
right there, I would cut that off. You know, if I'm in the White House press corps, I'm going to say, when you say they, who are you talking about?
Exactly.
Because, you know, I think we've all been asking this question since January 20th of who's really calling the shots in this White House. It's, you know, in my judgment, it's not Biden, and it's not Kamala Harris either.
You
constantly hear this reference to, you know, they're going to get upset at me. They told me to say this. They are, you know, asking me to do A, B, or C. Who is the they? You know, because as you correctly said in your opening, one of the first things that should happen and should have happened abruptly was, you know, accountability here. You know, my messaging on this, let me just say, this is a hypothesis, not a proven fact, but you have to operate on you have to operate at this point on either this is mismanagement, lack of expertise and bad intelligence. That's a scenario. Or as I'm inclined to believe, this is in fact the desired outcome, meaning the administration knew full well that this Afghan army was not prepared to defend the capital or the administrative buildings of the federal capital. You know, beginning with the abandonment at Bagram Airfield, they were essentially laying the ground for the empowerment of the Taliban. Now, what would motivate such a seemingly irrational plan is a good question, because the way I presented it in early July as it relates to Bagram, and I think you can present this as it relates to the rushed, abrupt withdrawal from Afghanistan. I mean, I can't think of the last time we left Americans in harm's way consciously, as we appear to be willing to do here. It's got to be a factor X, really, in my theory. So the motivating factor here is not the United States, the protection of Americans, or U.S. security interests in Central Asia, nor is it the humanitarian conditions and prognosis of the Afghan people. It's clearly, as I look at it, utterly, you know, not conditioned to either one of those considerations. So what would prompt it? Well, what would prompt it potentially would be either an incentive or disincentive for failure to act from some other foreign consideration, which is something that I think really needs to be investigated. I think it's a basis for the impeachment, let's call it an inquiry, because part of an impeachment process should be to get to the heart of some facts that we don't know. So I would support that in this case. I mean, there's no logically defending this series of actions And no one, you know, no entry-level military member would look at this and say, this makes sense for the United States, or this makes sense for the future of Afghanistan. This makes no sense. And the outcome based on these decisions was, in my view, fully known to this administration and this president. And they were, you know, essentially not concerned significantly enough about that. And, you know, there's, I believe, some other motivating consideration that's driving this, which get, you know, and now you start to get into speculation usually, but it's just one of the reasons that I think, you know, the three of us, for instance, have raised this issue of Hunter Biden's conflicts of interest with China and all of these conflicts of interest. And we may not even know about all of them, but this, you know, nearly 50-year career of this feckless leader who has not led at all and is not leading now, but is, you know, essentially making decisions, started with the border, the open border, getting rid of the stay in Mexico policy, now into Afghanistan, are just so clearly self-destructive that you can't really write them off to bad fortune or miscalculation.
If you recall, General Robert Gates has said on more than one occasion
in his book
that, that Biden has been wrong about foreign affairs for the past four decades. Andrew, that speaks volume as to who we have sitting in the White House and who knows what he's doing and who doesn't. What do you say?
Yeah, not just foreign affairs. It just seems about every issue Joe Biden's always been on the wrong side of. How much of it is Joe Biden is just not current enough or up to date in the current state of affairs to intellectually understand what is going on in a lot of these cases, particularly Afghanistan, Michael?
Well, you know, my position on that is I don't know the answer to his clinical or mental state exactly. It's clear that it's somehow compromised and he's not the person that he was a decade ago. But that almost doesn't even really matter significantly because he's surrounded by, you know, a broad range of professionals who should know enough to be providing him with competent judgment on these issues. You know, and you heard him say how he had spent the whole day on the phone with the Pentagon and in with Afghan on the field military personnel, and this was the guidance he was getting. Well, you know, I mean, so far the Biden Pentagon hasn't shown a lot of focus on national security needs. They've been very glued into this woke agenda, very glued into the social dynamics of the pressures of the left, which I think, frankly, you know, if you're on the left right now, you got to be feeling pretty positive about your status. You look at the military as almost the last remaining institution in the United States. It's not been penetrated by and controlled essentially by your ideological outlook, right? I mean, they have, as we've talked about, academia, media, Hollywood, Fortune 500 corporations, at least, not maybe not small business, but a big business. And everybody's kind of like, you know, playing to their conducted tune. And the military is kind of this last bastion. I very rarely come across any retired military personnel that buy into the left's view on things. In fact, one time I'm thinking back all the way into the late 80s, I discovered this retired admiral, Eugene LaRock, who was, had put together this organization. He was coming out against all these weapons systems. And I went and interviewed him, wrote a big article on it, in fact. But, you know, he was motivated, basically had been passed over by some promotions and was like an alternative agenda, basically, that he was pursuing. I cannot for the life of me envision anyone who's given their career and life to a military service and to rise to these positions, you pretty much have had to do that, who would look at this situation, this 20-year war, and, you know, 2,420 fallen Americans and trillions of dollars, and walk away to have the same situation exist, probably more dangerous now with the potential major power alliances of a much more hostile China today than existed back in 2001. And Pakistan, you know, just historically, I will tell you, having been very involved in support for the Mujahideen forces during the Soviet occupation, has always had their intelligence service, the ISI, has always had a bias toward the more radical elements of Islamic extremism within Afghanistan. They view that as a mechanism for both controlling Afghanistan and keeping it divided, which is kind of their realpolitik vision in a way for Afghanistan, and not allowing it to grow in any way that eclipses its neighbor in Pakistan. In fact, had Pakistan throughout this 20-year war not allowed the Taliban entry into Pakistan, where it retreated pretty commonly and was given safe haven, this war would have been more definitively and more quickly won. So if you have been a supporter of the conflict and you're struggling to answer why it's taken 20 years for us to essentially reach a stalemate, one of the primary rebuttals I would give you is the fact that, much like did exist in South Vietnam with Laos and Cambodia, the enemy here has had safe haven with a country that we have an important relationship with in Pakistan, an important but turbulent relationship, I guess would be the way to word it.
Yeah, well said. Great first half, Michael Johns. We will be back with Michael Johns, co-founder of the Tea Party, and you are tuned into After Dark with Robin Andrew, available on America Out Loud via iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the America Out Loud app to keep track of all the shows. We will be back with more on After Dark with Robin Andrew.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
The America Out Loud family is comprised of patriots in the true sense of the word. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. It is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty and the Constitution to help save America for future generations to come. AmericaOutLoud.com. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
And we're back with After Dark with Robin Andrew. And when we went to break, we were talking to Michael about the Mujahideen and the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And I think what a lot of people fail to realize is that in this particular region, there have been other groups that have gone into this country and tried to, I guess, occupy them or settle them or get them to conform to their standards, their way of life. We were there for the past 20 years, and we were unsuccessful. Now, from my readings and from listening to different media outlets, it appears that our generals have been telling the past couple of presidents, Bush, Obama, Trump, and even Biden, that things were okay in Afghanistan, when in actuality, they weren't okay. So the intel that these presidents were getting was flawed and false, because now we see that whenever our troops would train these Afghanistan, they would get paid, and then they would go wander off into the hills, into the mountains. So they would have to bring on another group, and the same thing would happen. So it does beg the question, what the hell were we doing for 20 years, and why were our generals not reporting the truth? Someone needs to answer these questions. And we need to get to the bottom of it. And we need to find out all the money that we have wasted in this country. And now China is going to try to go in and they're going to try to take a crack at it. I don't know if they'll be successful or not. But Michael, tell us about the Mujahideen when they were there.
Well, the Mujahideen were not one single entity. So if you go back to 1979, Carter, much like Biden, was projecting a lot of weakness around the world. The Soviets, inspired by that weakness and inspired by a desire to expand their foothold in Central Asia, kill, assassinate the president of Afghanistan, and then subsequently invade the country in 1979. And that really was what kicked off the Reagan Doctrine. It, you know, was first considered, you know, by the Carter sort of NSC staff. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who I think died a year or two ago, was pretty involved in starting to consider it. And then, of course, Reagan and the Heritage Foundation, where I was sort of the key foreign policy analyst on the Reagan Doctrine, we picked it up. And the idea was that we were not going to engage the Soviet Union directly in these in their expansionist ventures into South Asia, Central Asia, Africa, and Latin America, but nor were we any longer going to just sit quietly and let it happen. And that if individuals in these countries expressed a desire to pick up arms and resist the Soviet-supported tyrannies that they were being repressed under, we would support those resistance movements. So we supported the Contras in Nicaragua. We supported Jonas Savimbi and UNITA in Angola, supported the so-called ANS forces under Prince Sihanouk in Cambodia, and we supported the Mujahideen within Afghanistan. And I visited with the Contras twice, into Angola with Savimbi, brought Savimbi to Washington as well, and into Cambodia with the Sihanouk forces. So I was like, not just, you know, being a policy wonk on these issues. I actually visited the front lines. These were very imperfect wars. I'm not, you know, necessarily apologizing for all of the, or defending all the acts of these resistance movements. They were all imperfect. But within the Afghan resistance, one man, Ahmad Shah Massoud, who I was a very strong vocal supporter of, and I was not alone, the Reagan administration felt highly of him too, was the most sort of U.S. aligned and friendly force within the resistance forces of the Mujahideen. He was not particularly liked, unfortunately, by Pakistan, and they diverted a lot of this aid that we had provided into the more radical elements. And as you probably now know, at least it's been pretty widely reported, I mean, among those who came into Afghanistan were so-called Arab Mujahideen, and that included a guy by the name of Osama bin Laden, who was also, you know, receiving Pakistani support at that time. And bin Laden was then known to U.S. intelligence and not viewed, you know, was viewed as a hostile and dangerous force that we wanted to keep aid away from. Now, did any U.S. aid get to bin Laden? It might have, because we didn't have reliable partnerships with Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI, which was essentially moving this aid over this very mountainous terrain that we had relied on them to do. Now, all of this is important in the present context because the Soviets, you know, then a major superpower, conquered and took control of all of Afghanistan with the exception of the northern region, the so-called Panjshir Valley. And this was controlled by Ahmad Shah Massoud, who had visited Europe and he visited the United States. He had cautioned in the last year of his life, he said, the United States and the West will know that they have something to be concerned about if anything happens to me. And I can remember hearing that and thinking, well, that's kind of like, as much as I supported him, a little bit presumptuous, but it turned out to not at all be presumptuous. It was spot on accurate. September 9th, 2001, 2 days before 9/11, several Al-Qaeda agents posing as journalists to interview him, you know, arrive up in the Panjshir Valley, very remote area by Tajikistan, and they turn out to have self-detonating explosive devices, and they kill themselves and Massoud. He is a hero in Afghanistan. That's not well known to many Americans, but, you know, there's a you know, many things named after him. I think there's a national holiday in his name. He's been declared by former President Karzai a national hero, a rare designation in Afghanistan. And September 9th, the day of his death, is known as Massoud Day in Afghanistan. So his son, Ahmad Massoud, is now headed to the north with Amarullah Saleh, who's the first vice president. But under the Constitution, which is the point I've been trying to make since the fall of Kabul, is under the Constitution, the interim president. So just real quickly, if you go and review back in 2003 and four, the Afghans begin to develop this constitution. They send over 500 Afghan men and women gather in essentially like their constitutional convention to adopt this document. And it's signed by the president. So it's, you know, as far as the rule of law goes in a fairly underdeveloped country, it's a very important document. It's not one that, and it was a document that was written, as I said, not for smooth sailing, but for precisely like a moment like this. So in a case like this, where, President Ghani flees Afghanistan, shows no intention, in my view, of returning. I don't believe he will return. Maybe that ends up proving inaccurate, but I'd be surprised if he returns. Saleh is to be recognized as the interim president, and they're to hold elections within 90 days. Now, my question is, if you discarded all of the horrific decisions that have been made by the Biden administration up to now, and, you know, frankly, by NATO as well, that the British have condemned Biden and things like that, but, you know, we're not seeing this leadership really emerge, and the world is looking for leadership right now. What kind of leadership would you provide? You know, in my judgment, it would be, you'd have a political dimension of it. The political dimension of leadership would be to say, the people of Afghanistan have adopted this constitution. It's not in any way been voided simply because a group of thugs had the willingness to put their lives on the line and take these buildings in Kabul and had the force to do so. That doesn't make them a government. This government continues on in line with the Constitution. And we recognize the interim vice president as the president. And then we should be calling on every major power of the world and every country of the world to do the same, which is why it's unbelievable on top of everything else that Kabul falls. And, you know, Jen Psaki's asked, well, you know, what heads of state has Biden called about the Afghanistan situation? And the answer is no one. He hasn't called Xi Jinping. He hasn't called Vladimir Putin. Hasn't called the Pakistanis. Hasn't called our friends in Riyadh and Saudi Arabia that have historically had great interest in Afghanistan. Hasn't called the former president of Afghanistan. I mean, hadn't called Boris Johnson. And the Brits, I think, lost several hundred of their citizens in the war against the Taliban. It's an unbelievable revelation of just astonishing disengagement, not just in the bad decisions leading up to the fall of the government, but in the aftermath of it to this very moment where we are being permissive of the Taliban's purported ascent, which has no basis in the rule of law, and it may have no basis in military fact either, if we would muster some degree of resistance, which is what makes Massoud interesting. Because I mentioned how the Soviets had taken all of Afghanistan. They did not take this Northern Alliance region that comprises almost a third of Afghanistan, the Panjshir Valley. And I think there's good reason to believe the geographic structure of that region of Afghanistan, which I know reasonably well, is going to be almost impossible to take militarily. The Soviets couldn't do it, and the Taliban had difficulty doing it during their reign. They couldn't really take it either. So it becomes intriguing now to have Massoud aligned with the first vice president, who's technically the interim president. And in my judgment, that's what we should be doing at this point. We're not getting cooperation out of the Taliban. And the signs so far, I mean, with this Marine killing, are that they're going to make this extraction enormously painful. It doesn't appear we got any concessions from the CIA director's visit over there. I think you send the CIA director over there probably because it was money involved. And I think we probably have compensated the Taliban to some extent for safe passage, which they're not even providing. And frankly, there's another, you know, example of something that really needs to be dived into as part of these impeachment proceedings or congressional inquiry of how much money have we paid the Taliban over the last 2 weeks throughout this ascent? And, right. and what is the and what precise military equipment has been left behind? It's sort of been estimated to be in the billions of dollars.
Here's something that I would say, because you brought up two interesting points here. The first thing's impeachment. I know that a lot of people are saying, stop talking about impeachment. We should look at defeating the Democrats in 2022 and 2024 by saying that Joe Biden is incompetent. I get it. I understand it. But I think we can do both. We need to keep that out there, because once the Democrats started making impeachment something that every president has to go through, I say continue along those lines. It's not to say that they will be able to remove Joe Biden. Or would we have weak Republicans, rhinos, that would say, no, let's let him stay? That's the first thing. I think he should be impeached. There's enough information out there to impeach him. You're going to impeach Trump on phone calls and on some phony baloney insurrection that the FBI
is saying. It's not reciprocity. I mean, we need to make that clear.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. It's not reciprocity. I agree with that. Okay. Now, the other thing you had mentioned, as far as the president of Afghanistan, he left the country. Oh, I've got to save myself. Who cares about the other people? I don't trust the guy. I never trusted him. I think he took the money and ran. Now he's somewhere else living the good life while Afghanistan is falling down. Here's the other thing that I think that people should be aware of. Afghanistan is the size of Texas, if that. We've so far removed 10,000 people plus and relocated them in America. But we can't save all of Afghanistan. Is the entire region influxed with the Taliban and all these terrorist groups? I'm not saying that we shouldn't look at it from a humanitarian standpoint, but why are we so afraid to go in, do the job, which is destroy, blow them up, we've taken care of it, now you guys fix it up. Why are we there trying to nation build? It's a waste of our time. And then, too, as you said, how much money have we sunk into this failed project that is going nowhere anytime soon?
Well, and here's what's, there's multiple components of what was failed about it, but here's one thing that's indisputably true and was indisputably flawed, and the generals, you know, lied to President Trump over, and that was the so-called ghost soldiers, meaning the number of armed combatants in the Afghan army was routinely inflated by commanders and by the government so they could pocket the excess payments. And this is what's also important to recognize when you look at Biden's decision-making. So, you know, I talk about the importance at the beginning of the abandonment of the primary air base. We've handled the handovers of air bases in Iraq, and we've done, I mean, there's a process that you follow through. It's usually ceremonial, it's incremental, you know, and it shows continuity of leadership of it. In this case, we just got up and ran away from it. This was also true in, back in April, was really the first sign of dangerous decision-making in Afghanistan when they began paying the soldiers through the Ghani government. From what I have gotten from contacts, some vast contacts of mine, I should say, because, you know, everyone's contacting me trying to get out now. I mean, I have well over 100 inquiries, either on behalf of themselves or others, of individuals who either were in the armed forces or were in the government or, you know, are associated with U.S. operations there. They all basically, when I've asked them, have told them that they had not received pay since like April. And that was when Biden made the decision to begin paying the military through the government. And that money never filtered through to the actual armed forces. So while it's true that the Afghan army was timid in the face of the Taliban advance, it's also true, if you haven't paid them for 4 months, that's not exactly a motivating consideration as far as defending the capital and asking people to put their lives on the line to defend it. And that too deserves careful scrutiny and questioning, is why would you make an adjustment of that nature? And why would you abandon the primary air base overnight. It was literally some articles out there about the Afghan commander of that base who woke up the next morning and like everybody was gone. There was no announcement, no advance notice even to him.
Why would they abandon that airport of all the airports? Why that one? Who gave him that intel that this particular airport, forget about it unless you use this one? And from what I'm hearing—
Well, plus, look, Rob, think about how helpful that would be right now to have in our hands.
Absolutely.
Even if the position was we are going to acquiesce to Taliban control of Afghanistan, but at least we're going to have the mechanism
right.
to get our get Americans out of Americans, both military and NGO and others that right. are there out of Afghanistan.
Right.
We're dealing with an airport in the Kabul airport that is substantially smaller than the airbase. That's a one runway airport.
Right. One way. So 13,000 soldiers killed as a result of Biden's ineffectiveness and whoever was giving him this information, and our woke generals. I don't know if you saw them on TV that day, Lloyd Austin and Mark Milley stumbling over the, I felt embarrassed. I'm like, wait a minute.
They didn't even appear remorseful.
Not at all.
That's why when I say there's one of two things has happened here, either gross incompetence or the execution of a plan, meaning they're executing exactly as they had planned. The goal essentially was to do this abrupt departure.
I would hate to think that.
Now I realize that's a very strong stretch to get your arms around and to embrace as an operating thesis. And I hope I'm wrong about it. But I want to say, as much as I disagree with this administration's high level military and diplomatic personnel on their vision of the world, and I do believe that they subscribe to what we've talked about, which is the managed decline of the United States of America in the world. I believe that's an operating thesis they've shown support for over their entire careers. It's much more difficult for me to conceive of the fact that with all of the planning capabilities and all of the infrastructure and extraordinary investments in these plans, and particularly in this war, that, you know, you would just sort of abruptly make a decision like this and think that was in your best. I mean, I can't really articulate how would that be in the best interest of U.S. interests and of the future of Afghanistan to leave military equipment, an entire airbase in the hands of the Taliban, to leave Americans behind while you're withdrawing, that they're not even defended.
Right.
We're heading into, we don't know what the future holds, but we're heading into a conceivable hostage situation, somewhat
reminiscent
of the Iranian hostage. And these guys, let me just say, you know, the Iranians were brutal toward America's hostages. These guys are even more ruthless. I mean, they are incredibly ruthless barbarians. What I can't understand is what the commander-in-chief and all of the military and intel resources at his disposal would be thinking in advising this path, because the only thing I can think about is the phone ringing and some foreign power entity saying, get your forces out in 48 hours or X. And you can speculate about what sort of foreign power might be inclined to make a call like that. You always, in these cases, have to kind of look at who are the beneficiaries, right? Two major global powers are the real beneficiaries. It's China's Communist Party, predominantly, because they need Afghanistan for this Belt and Road Initiative development plan of theirs, which really every American's got to study up on at this point. I mean, we can't rely simply on the elite of our government to be understanding and countering this. You read up on the Belt and Road Initiative, but we just leave it at that. And Pakistan, which is a nuclear power. And I'll tell you who's immensely concerned, because I'm hearing from them a lot, is India, which becomes, in my view, a very important now bilateral relationship with the United States. Not that it wasn't before, but our relationship with India becomes hugely, hugely important now.
The question that I would have is that, will China be successful? Will they be able to contain Afghanistan?
I can tell you, interestingly, in my debate engagement with China's Communist Party on China's state-owned television, they blame what they perceive to be the radicalization of the Uyghurs on our presence in Afghanistan. Now, that's completely wrong.
Interesting.
Let me just say that the radicalization of Afghanistan is not without some risk to China. They better be tuned into that. And let me just say that the history of military occupation in Afghanistan is one of universal failure. We're the most powerful military in the world. We've clearly shown an incapability of doing it. The Soviets before us were incapable of doing it. Mikhail Gorbachev called Afghanistan a bleeding wound, as I recall. And the British before them were incapable of doing it. These are warring tribes that will align when necessary and then fight each other when not necessary. And they are highly trained geographically and militarily in combat. So, yeah, I think you raise a very good point there, Rob, is that they may approach us in a much more sophisticated way in the sense, well, I don't want to say sophisticated, less humanitarian way than we have. I mean, we went in, you know, we would build schools and the Taliban would blow them up and then we'd rebuild the school, right? You know, this is how this kind of went. I wouldn't anticipate China's Communist Party being too concerned about educating young girls of Afghanistan or the human rights conditions. I think they go in there, it's going to be strictly a commercial engagement where they build basically this super highway between Afghanistan and Pakistan that is a key part of their trying to monopolize the trade routes of that region of the world.
Yeah, Michael, this has got to be the biggest foreign policy disaster of my lifetime.
Yeah.
Can you think of anything like this, maybe Jimmy Carter? And how big of a blemish is this going to be on Joe Biden's presidency when we look back in history?
Look, unless there is some alternative plan, all right, and which would almost certainly include a military re-engagement of some sort, it's monstrous. Let me just say, as it relates to Carter, one thing I could tell you about Carter's errors in foreign policy is that they had a common theme. They were explainable. He undermined Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua over human rights concerns. And then in came the Sandinistas, the Cubans, and the Soviets. The human rights conditions got worse, and we had an enemy, right? So it was a bad calculation, but at least the motivating factor was human rights concerns with an ally. He did the same thing to the Shah of Iran in 1979 in Iran, where the Shah was certainly very imperfect as it related to his human rights record, but was nowhere near as abusive as the Ayatollah. And the Ayatollah comes in and we get worse human rights and an enemy. So you've kind of this recurring theme. And it's one thing that Reagan, to his great credit, understood when he went in, for instance, in the Philippines to replace Marcos. The one thing that Reagan understood from Carter's errors, or he just understood instinctually because he made good judgments, was that you don't replace or undermine an allied government without a very clear understanding of what comes next, exactly what comes next. Carter never understood that. And at least you could understand the motivating consideration was one of human rights, even though human rights were regressed on Carter's watch. In this case, you know, if you ask me for some plausible explanation of why you would leave, do we even have a number, by the way, of how many Americans are?
Nope, we don't. We're still waiting for that number.
And I mean, find but it's very clearly a four-figure number, right?
Oh, and absolutely.
I mean, if we're 10 Americans, it would be enormously concerning. This is thousands. You know, with no clear-cut mechanism for exiting, and this inaccurate presumption somehow because they haven't gotten to the airport in the midst of a civil war when they're scattered, you know, some are in Kabul, but many are throughout the whole country, that they don't have a desire to leave is an unbelievably arrogant.
I don't buy that at all.
No, it's completely inconceivable.
Right.
We don't even have any communication with these people. And then on top of it all, we didn't mention the laptop left behind in the U.S. Embassy with all of the contacts, the interpreters that we've used throughout this entire war. It's like we've given the Taliban the list of all of our allied U.S. and Afghan citizens in the country for them to target.
And it makes you wonder if it was done deliberately, since they were saying, right, if they were saying that the pullout was deliberate, like, so was this done deliberately?
It's a very difficult thing to say, but it's, you know, I'm awaiting some sort of intelligent explanation from July 4th, well, take it all the way back to April with the decision on the payments, which they must have known since April that the Afghan army was not being paid, right? So, and they obviously made no change. I mean, there was no reversal of course. You could have, I mean, you could have justified that move saying, hey, this will maybe eliminate some of the ghost payments and these overpayments. But you certainly by May or June are aware, if you've got any degree of ear to the ground in Afghanistan, that the military aren't being paid. And then the air base is totally irrational. I mean, I felt that way in early July. And I thought that way thinking that it was a singular decision, not an irrational decision in a series of irrational decisions. You almost wonder what comes next. I mean, it, you know, it certainly appears we're prepared to abandon Americans for the first time, really, in the history of this country, you know, to an enemy known for its ruthlessness. And we consciously have handed this country over to the Taliban. That may have ultimately been inevitable, but it wasn't inevitable on day one. And I said during the fall of the cities leading up to the fall of Kabul that, you know, the government did benefit from having an air force. The Taliban had no air force, right? That's not a small factor. And, you know, while the numbers in the Afghan army are under dispute, roughly twice the size of that of the Taliban. So you had some decent basis to have some degree of optimism that the capital city, at least, could be defended and thus the government. But, you know, really the American presence there, this is the way I would word it. The Afghan army was trained to fight side by side with Americans under American direction. They were never taught to fight on their own. And then given that first challenge of doing it, it was overwhelming. It wasn't the conviction that was needed, probably inspired by the pay. And you have the Taliban, which, as we all know, motivated by Islamic extremism, are more than willing to die for whatever they perceive to be this higher cause that they're allegedly serving. And the message is not so. Central Asia, you might look at this and think this is not, this is a crucial region of the world. We have a clear strategic stake in all this. And I'm one who supported President Trump's decision to end these endless wars, but to do it on our terms and to avoid re-engagement in them, but not under these circumstances. Not 20 years into this do you go through all of this. And now we're going to come up on the 9/11 holiday, and we're going to list off those 3,000 names again, but this time the very terrorist supporting entity that we ousted with the October 2001 invasion of Afghanistan is once again governing that nation now with billions of dollars of our own equipment and potentially the support of at least two regional powers.
Thank you so much, Michael Johns. What a great show tonight. If you want to check out the last time we had Michael on, he talked about China. It's called China on the Rise. You can go to AmericaOutloud.com and type in China on the Rise. And our last show we had with Michael Johns will pop up. Thank you so much, Michael. And thank you all for joining us tonight on After Dark with Robin Andrew. Check us out and all the other shows over at AmericaOutloud.com. You can also find America Out Loud on iHeartRadio, Spotify, or Stitcher. We will see you guys next time. And remember, stand for something or you will fall for nothing.